bright lines for this hour. Israel's indiscriminate strikes and artillery fire killed over 30 Palestinians in 24 hours as a death toll from the regime's genocide tops 34,380. Violent clashes break out after Israeli forces attack thousands of protesters demanding the resignation of the regime's premier and a deal to release the captives. And hundreds of pro-Palestine protesters hold a rally in Washington, D.C., condemning the U.S. administration's unbridled support for Israel's genocide in Gaza. Thank you for joining us. Israel's genocide war in Gaza continues to claim the lives of more Palestinian civilians across the besieged strip. A fresh Israeli airstrike on a residential building near the southern city of Rafah killed at least 10 Palestinians. Israeli airstrikes targeted two houses in the Al Burej and Nusayrat refugee camps in central Gaza Strip, killing three civilians and injuring several others. In the past 24 hours, Israeli occupation forces conducted four massacres which took the lives of at least 32 Palestinians and injured 69 others. Since last October, with the start of the regime's onslaught in the besieged territory, around 34,390 Palestinians have lost their lives and over 77,000 others were injured. Many of them are women and children. Thousands of the victims also remain trapped under the rubble as Israeli forces prevent ambulance and civil defense crews from reaching them. Our correspondent Moti Abu Musabbeh joined us earlier from the central Gaza city of Deir al-Balah for an update on the situation in the besieged territory. Let's hear listen.
As you know, that the Israeli warplanes carried out their airstrikes against that residential building. The vast majority of those Palestinian civilians who were killed over the attack were from children and women. At least four Palestinian children were unalived over the attack. It's worth mentioning that Rafah City has been under heavy bombardments and attacks over the last couple of months as the Israeli occupation forces intensified their attacks against the city. Here in the central area of Gaza Strip, the Israeli military boats opened their heavy gunfire towards the coastal area of Deir al-Balah city. While when it comes to Gaza City, the Israeli warplanes also continued their attacks against the eastern part of the city. Those areas, the eastern parts of Gaza City, were also targeted by the heavy bombardments of the Israeli artillery shelling. While when it comes to the northern part of the Gaza Strip, the Israeli artillery shelling also continued targeting and attacking the northern part of Gaza Strip. On the other hand, the Palestinian civilians are still suffering from these catastrophic humanitarian conditions that are still befalling them. Needless to mention that many municipalities in Gaza Strip also released multiple appeals demanding urgent help in order, as you know, just to contain this rising crisis of the contaminated and polluted drinkable water, as the Palestinian people are facing a severe shortage of the drinkable water due to the systematic destruction of the water wells.
A humanitarian aid flotilla destined for Gaza has been blocked in Turkey after Guinea-Bissau decides to remove its flag from two of the vessels.
On Friday afternoon, before the inspection was even completed, the Guinea-Bissau International Ships Registry, in a blatantly political move, informed the Freedom Flotilla Coalition that it had withdrawn the Guinea-Bissau flag from two of our ships, one of which is our cargo ship, already loaded with over 5,000 tons of life-saving aid for the Palestinians of Gaza. Without a flag, we cannot sail. But this is not the end. Israel cannot and will not crush our resolve to break its illegal siege and reach the people of Gaza.
The activists also said Guinea-Bissau had made several extraordinary requests for information. They described those requests and inspections as unusual and political. The Turkish Humanitarian Relief Foundation is the primary organization of the Civilian Freedom Flotilla Coalition. The group is comprised of human rights activists, including lawyers, doctors and nurses, who came together to deliver aid directly to Gaza. About 280 of them were present at the press conference and shouted slogans in support of Palestine. Three of the flotilla's ships have been docked for a week south of Istanbul, and it was planned to set sail on Friday. Israeli security forces have violently clashed with protesters in Tel Aviv calling for snap elections and the resignation of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu. Security forces cracked down on protesters gathering outside the headquarters of the Israeli occupation forces in central Tel Aviv. Protests were also held in more than 50 settlements across occupied Palestine. Israeli protesters argue that Netanyahu has failed to secure the release of the captives held in Gaza. They demand that the Israeli cabinet strike a deal with the Hamas resistance movement to return the captives. Israeli officials say 129 captives remain in the Gaza Strip. Dozens of the captives have also been killed in the regime's airstrikes on Gaza. Hamas says it wants a complete ceasefire and the withdrawal of Israeli forces from Gaza as part of a ceasefire deal to release the captives. In the United States Capitol, pro-Palestinian protesters gather outside the venue of the annual White House Correspondents Association dinner in a bid to highlight the Israeli genocide in Gaza. Protesters were angry at the U.S. president for his support for the Israeli killing machine. They shouted slogans such as "Shame on you" and "Hands off Gaza." Some demonstrators performed acts symbolizing Israel's atrocities in the occupied territories as they demanded an immediate ceasefire in Gaza. Several protesters were arrested by security forces. Earlier, Palestinian journalists called for the boycott of the event. The protest was organized by Code Pink, a non-profit organization that accuses U.S. media of co-opting the Biden administration's involvement in the genocide. It says it aims to raise awareness of how the U.S. media perpetuates anti-Palestine narratives while ignoring Israeli war crimes. Anti-Israel protests are gaining momentum on U.S. campuses as more and more university students are standing in solidarity with Palestinians. The students camped out for the second day on the George Washington University campus despite threats that they could face temporary suspension. The students at Arizona State University also joined the wave of U.S. campus protests against the ongoing Israeli genocide in Gaza. In the state of Illinois, hundreds of protesters marched on the University of Chicago campus. They echoed pro-Palestinian chants that have been reverberating through multiple American universities over the past days. Around 100 people were arrested at a university in Boston. Encampments in support of Palestine also continued at New York's Columbia University. The Education Center has been an epicenter of anti-Israel protests since April 18th. In over a week, hundreds of protesters have been arrested at colleges across the U.S. The protesting students demand university authorities divest from companies involved in Israel's military.
The genocide taking place in the Gaza Strip continues to claim civilian lives. The focus of this U.S.-Israeli genocide has now turned to universities, in particular in the United States. What began as anti-Israel and pro-Palestinian protests, mainly in the U.S., however, has now spread to other parts of the world, and from the looks of it, these won't subside anytime soon. In all, as of April 26, you're looking at about 28 a total of 40 universities across the U.S. spread in 28 states out of the 50 states. That is more than half of all U.S. states, by the way, who are conducting pro-Palestine universities protests. Keeping in mind, these numbers may increase, but this shows the depth of how widespread it is. What do protesters want? These are some of the demands. They include a ceasefire in the Gaza Strip, a halt to U.S. military aid to the Israeli regime, divesting money away from Israel or in companies supporting Israel, and a recognition of a right to protest on campus without retribution. Numerous pro-Palestine groups have popped up, such as FSJP-CBT. They are a collective of Columbia University, Barnard College, and Teachers College faculty, staff, and graduate workers. dedicated to Palestinian freedom, calling for things like academic boycott, as you see here, also appalled by police action against the protesters. The response by the U.S. Secretary of State, Antony Blinken, fell way short of appeasing the protesters. He said that these protests are a hallmark of U.S. democracy, that our citizens make known their anger at a given time. And I think that reflects the strength of the country. Do these scenes here look like a hallmark of U.S. democracy, which is in stark contrast to over, at this point, 600 arrests that have been made involving police violence, where the U.S. Secretary of State also tried to shift the blame on Hamas by saying, now, as I have said before, this could be over tomorrow if Hamas put down its weapons, stopped hiding behind civilians, released the hostages, and surrendered. He, in essence, is shifting the blame onto the resistance group Hamas, questioning the silence about Palestinian resistance group Hamas. Not only students, professors are not buying the U.S. lines also. This is just one example where this one particular professor has said, in light of the university's current repression and criminalization of students. Gives you an idea of how widespread, again, this is. From students, you have to protesters, and then you go to U.S. government officials. Well, let's take a look at the State Department's resignations are pointing to a dissent. For example, the most recent one, the U.S. State Department spokesperson for the Middle East and North Africa, Hala Rarit, the one on the far left there, and another two which have resigned altogether, being three. As a matter of fact, since we're mentioning the U.S. State Department, in November 2023, 1,000 officials at USAID, that's part of the State Department, signed an open letter calling for an immediate ceasefire, criticizing the administration's policy toward Gaza, Palestine, and also the U.S. military aid. No doubt have the U.S. university protests had a contagion effect, spreading to other colleges around the world, some of which you see here, combined with the other sectors of society worldwide that are holding pro-Palestine, anti-Israeli protests, some on a weekly, if not on a daily basis. What is there left of Israel's world standing?
It's been another day of protests across major European cities in solidarity with Palestinians. In the UK, tens of thousands marched through central London, reiterating calls for an immediate ceasefire and the UK's arming for the Israeli regime. Saipul Reza reports.
As the world celebrated 30 years since the end of apartheid in South Africa, protesters assembled in their thousands in London, calling for an end to the Israeli apartheid and echoing the global demand for a ceasefire in Gaza.
We are here to call for the victory of the Palestinian struggle, that for us it means the end of this genocidal war against Gaza, against the West Bank for us, and against all the Palestinian people.
It's not in our name. We are selling, England is selling arms to Israel, and it's got to stop. They're creating genocide, and we don't want any part of it.
At the destination of the march in Hyde Park, speaker after speaker, including Northern Ireland's First Minister Michelle O'Neill, called out the American, European, and British government's complicity in the Israeli regime's crimes.
Peace is always possible.
The march came only weeks after the British Prime Minister gave a Downing Street address condemning extremism and saying the protests risked descending into mob rule, and his counter-extremism commissioner claimed London was becoming a no-go zone for Jews on Saturdays. That received pushback from a number of Jewish community leaders and members. And so the tussle between pro-Palestine marchers exercising their freedom of speech and those who want to cancel those marches continue.
The main theme of this protest, as with the previous ones, the killing of so many civilians in the Gaza Strip and the continued UK military and diplomatic support for the Israeli regime. There's also an element of defiance, too, to all the attempts that have been made to disrupt and to antagonize these protests. The protesters here are saying they aren't going anywhere and that they will be coming back again and again as long as the massacre continues. Saipur is up, London.
Supporters of Palestine marched past the U.S. and Israeli embassies in Seoul on Saturday as Israel's attacks on Rafah expand, with reports suggesting an Israeli ground offensive within days. Correspondent Frank Smith reports from the South Korean capital, Seoul.
In South Korea Saturday, protesters of U.S.-Israeli genocide in Gaza marched past the U.S. embassy and through Seoul's downtown. Abuse and arrests of pro-Palestinian demonstrators at American colleges resonated with South Korean students.
Politicians and the media, in their attempt to justify such a crackdown, slander the Palestinian Solidarity Movement as spreading anti-Semitism. But history will remember them as accomplices in genocide.
This is the 32nd rally of South Korea's people in solidarity with Palestine, protesting against Israel's ongoing genocide in Gaza. As more and more reports surface outlining Israeli atrocities there, concern here grows over the situation in Rafah and Israel's increasing attacks against civilians there.
Participants call for a stoppage to Israel's imminent ground invasion of Rafah. At Seoul National University, a professor is under investigation for defacing a pro-Palestine poster after harassing a student. Such pressure tactics are seen by some demonstrators as an opportunity to set the record straight.
The professor, who's a Zionist, obviously, is trying to silence our voices about speaking up about against the genocide that is happening in Gaza and the occupation of Palestine. But at the same time, I feel like this is a chance for us to raise more awareness about what is happening and about why Zionism is, why Zionism is bad.
Meanwhile, at the United Nations, the United States became even more isolated, vetoing the April 18th resolution to extend full membership to Palestine, with several U.S. allies, including South Korea, voting in favor. Frank Smith, Seoul.
With that, we come to the end of this bulletin. Thank you for listening. Take care and bye-bye for now.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
A controversial UK government bill to send asylum seekers to Rwanda has finally secured the approval of the upper house of the British Parliament, which had demanded numerous amendments as Prime Minister Rishi Sunak promised to start the first flights to Kigali within weeks. We take a look at some of the world press and media's coverage of this story. Please stay with us. The British newspaper The Guardian has covered this story and tells us more. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak's Rwanda deportation bill will become law after peers eventually back down on amending it, opening the way for legal battles over the potential removal of dozens of people seeking asylum. After a marathon battle of ping-pong over the key legislation between the House of Commons and the House of Lords, the bill finally passed when opposition and crossbench peers gave way on Monday night, 22nd of April. The bill is expected to be granted royal assent in the coming days. Home Office sources said they have already identified a group of asylum seekers with weak legal claims to remain in the United Kingdom who will be part of the first tranche to be sent to East Africa in July. Prime Minister Sunak has put the bill, which would deport asylum seekers who arrive in the United Kingdom by irregular means to Kigali in Rwanda, at the centre of his attempts to stop small boats crossing the channel. The Home Secretary, James Cleverly, claimed it was a landmark moment in our plan to stop the boats. In a video posted to social media sites, he said, "The Safety of Rwanda Bill has passed in Parliament and it will become law within days." James Cleverly noted, "The Act will prevent people from abusing the law by using false human rights claims to block removals, and it makes clear that the British Parliament is sovereign, giving government the power to reject interim blocking measures imposed by European courts of law." Cleverly added, "I promised to do what was necessary to clear the path for the first flight. That's what we have done. Now we're working day in and day out to get flights off the ground." Denisa Delich, Director of Advocacy at International Rescue Committee UK, said on Monday, 22nd of April, "Irrespective of today's passage of the Safety of Rwanda Bill, sending refugees to Rwanda is an ineffective, unnecessarily cruel and costly approach." Delich added, "Rather than outsourcing its responsibilities under international law, we urge the government to abandon this misguided plan and instead focus on delivering a more humane and orderly immigration system at home." She added, "This includes scaling up safe routes such as resettlement and family reunion and upholding the right to seek asylum in Britain." The UK Home Office has whittled the list down to 350 migrants who are deemed to pose the least risk of submitting successful legal challenges blocking their deportation. Lawyers have told The Guardian that they will prepare legal challenges on behalf of individual asylum seekers. They can challenge their removal on a case-by-case basis, which could lead to their being taken off a flight list. The bill allows challenges if a detainee faces a real, imminent and foreseeable risk of serious, irreversible harm if removed to Rwanda. They must lodge an appeal within 8 days of receiving a deportation letter. The Home Office would then be given several days to respond. If their appeal is rejected, the person claiming asylum will then be given 7 days to lodge a final appeal to an upper tribunal court, which will decide their claim within a further 23 days. The National Audit Office has confirmed the deal will cost £1.8 million for each of the first 300 deportees. It claimed this includes scaling up safe routes such as resettlement and family reunion and upholding the right to seek asylum in Britain. Matthew Rycroft, the most senior civil servant in the Home Office, who has overseen the scheme for 2 years, previously told MPs he did not have evidence to show that it had a deterrent effect that would make it value for money. Home Office staff have privately warned that there is a risk of thousands of asylum seekers disappearing once removals begin, keen to avoid receiving notification that they are being sent to Kigali in Rwanda. Earlier, MPs stripped out amendments to the bill inserted by the House of Lords. Crossbench and Labour peers said they would reinsert similar changes in a battle of wills. The website Reddit has also covered the same story and tells us more. A UK Home Office minister told peers during one of the many debates held on Monday evening, 22nd of April, the government will not send those who are eligible under the Afghan Relocations and Assistance Policy to Rwanda. Lord Sharp said, "Once this review of Arab decisions for those with credible links to Afghan specialist units has concluded, the government will not remove to Rwanda those who receive a positive eligibility decision as a result of this review, where they are already in the UK as of today." Lord Brown, a Labour former defence secretary who had been leading calls for such an assurance, said, "The minister does not believe this to be a concession. It is to him a restatement of what he has been telling us for some time, but in a different form." Meanwhile, a leading lawyer and independent crossbencher, Lord Anderson of Ipswich, said of the Rwanda scheme, "Its benefits remain to be seen. Its costs will be measured, not only in money terms, but in principles debased. Disregard for our international commitments, avoiding statutory protections for the vulnerable, and the removal of judicial scrutiny over the core issue of the safety of Rwanda." The Prime Minister, Rishi Sunak, also disclosed that the first flights removing asylum seekers to Rwanda were planned to depart in 10 to 12 weeks, missing his original spring target. At a specially convened press conference on Monday morning, 22nd of April, Rishi Sunak said the government would not let a foreign court block flights to Rwanda and stressed that he would finally end the legal merry-go-round associated with deportation flights. He said, "Enough is enough. No more prevarication, no more delay. Parliament will sit there tonight and vote no matter how late it goes. No ifs, no buts. These flights are going on to Rwanda." The Labour Party said Sunak was wrong to blame the party's peers for delaying the Rwanda bill. Yvette Cooper, the Shadow Home Secretary, said the Tories are the largest party in both Houses of Parliament and they could have scheduled the final stages of the bill a month ago, but they voluntarily delayed it because they always want someone else to blame. More than 18,000 asylum seekers are threatened with being sent to Rwanda and are now having their cases processed in the UK instead. Freedom of information data obtained by the website Reddit reveals that between January of 2021 and June of 2023, about three-quarters or 18,078 of those who previously received notice of intent letters indicating their claims would not be processed in the United Kingdom have been subsequently admitted into the asylum system. A notice of intent letter is issued after the Home Office has declared an asylum claim inadmissible and removal from the UK is being considered. Data previously obtained from the Home Office about the number of notices issued over a similar period, January of 2021 to March of 2023, revealed 24,083 notices were issued.
This is A to Z. An introduction into Islamic lifestyle. Today's lesson, controlling your tongue. Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. You are listening to A to Z and we want to talk about controlling your tongue. Well, in Islamic tradition, we have the concept of lisanul khair and lisanul shar. Well, lisanul khair is a type of a tongue or is a type of a speech which you use for the perfection of yourself and others. So you don't hurt other people by your speech. And you always use your tongue to help people gain the goodness and reach at their perfection within your family, within your surroundings, with your colleagues, and everywhere you go, you use this tool of speech and your tongue for goodness, for helping others, for suggesting good things to others. You don't hurt other people by your tongue. So this is the concept of lisanul khair, a tongue which spreads the goodness, which spreads the hope, which spreads the beauty in the society. This is lisanul khair. And on other side, we have lisanul shar, the evil tongue or the evil speech.
That's the type of a tongue that creates separation within people. It's a type of a tongue, it's a type of a speech which hurts people, which it's a type of a speech which make other people hopeless. It abuses people. It's a type of a tongue which creates problem and corruption in society. And you know how immense corruption is created in society by use of the speech through propaganda and through backbiting and bad commenting upon the actions of others. So in Sharia and in Islam, we are taught to have a lisanul khair, a tongue or a speech which invites towards goodness, which is a source and a tool for goodness in the society. Welcome back. You are listening to A to Z, and we are talking about controlling the tongue and having good speech. Okay, the Holy Prophet, peace be upon him, says, وَهَلْ يَكُبُّ النَّاسُ فِي النَّارِ إِلَّا حَصَائِدُ أَلْسِنَتِهِمْ وَهَلْ يُكِبُّ النَّاسُ فِي النَّارِ إِلَّا حَصَائِدُ أَلْسِنَتِهِمْ If you want to know what drives people and what sends people to the hell, it's their wrong use of their tongue. So one of the causes in the hereafter, when people will go to hell instead of heavens, instead of paradise, is the wrong use of their tongue. They use it for teasing others, for hurting others, for spreading the wrong things in society, for disheartening people. So this type of use of tongue leads to the nar. It leads to the, in the understanding of Islamic tradition, it leads to hell. And it not just leads to hell, it also makes this world a hell. If you look at the society, the goodness about society comes, a lot of goodness about society comes from a good use of your tongue. And the evil part in society, where people do bad things, where people develop bad ideas, where people develop bad habits, where people develop bad things, all comes from a wrong use of their speech and tongue. So that's why in Islam there has been focus upon the rational and a good use of your tongue and speech. There is a saying by the Holy Prophet that says, لا يستقيم إيمان عبد حتى يستقيم قلبه. Someone cannot become straight in the path of faith if his heart is not straight in the path of faith. And his heart cannot straight in the path of faith if his tongue is not straight in the path of faith. So there is a connection between our speech and our heart. If you use your tongue for negative purposes, your heart will lose a portion of faith. I ask Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala, He may help us to control our tongue and use it for good in the society. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
IRIB English Radio. Our website is parsetoday.ir.
You can email us at englishradio@irib.ir.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
In the limelight.
The Palestinian Civil Defense said recently it has found hundreds of bodies of Palestinians buried in mass graves by Israeli regime forces in the courtyard of Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in southern Gaza Strip. The bodies of children, elderly women and young men were among those found. In this regard, we have taken a look at world media websites and news agencies for further details. Stay tuned for more. Middle East Eye wrote, video journalist Mohtasem Mortaja describes the scene at Nasser Hospital, where hundreds of bodies have been discovered since Israeli troops pulled out. Mohtasem Mortaja is a Palestinian video journalist in Khan Yunis, southern Gaza. Over recent days, he has been documenting mass graves uncovered in Nasser Hospital, where more than 300 bodies have been discovered since Israeli regime forces withdrew. Recently, his video of a woman in grey holding the recently uncovered body of her son spread across social media. Here, he describes the scene. He wrote, hundreds of mothers have come here to the Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis. They're looking for their children, moving from body to body, inspecting each one with the greatest detail. They pass their eyes and their hands over the corpses, seeing if they are wearing a shirt, a pair of trousers, perhaps some shoes that will identify their child among the 300 people found in these mass graves. The mothers just need a simple, essential detail to recognize their sons. That was how the woman in gray found hers. The rest of his features had dissolved and disappeared. The Zionist regime laid siege to Khan Yunis for 3 months. Nasser Hospital, the second largest in Gaza and the backbone of medical services in the south, became a haven for 10,000 Palestinians sheltering from attacks. But Israeli regime forces repeatedly raided the hospital in January and February, completely shutting it down, arresting staff and sending thousands of homeless Palestinians fleeing. Now, after troops pulled out earlier this month, experts have discovered the Israelis buried hundreds of people around the hospital's perimeter. The first day, the graves were discovered, 70 bodies were uncovered. The next day, it was 70 more. Dead Palestinians were buried underground, left beneath trees, and abandoned in the hospital's wards. Recently, rescue workers found a few dozen more, bringing the total up to 310. The air is heavy with the smell of death. It's inescapable in every corner, and worse with everybody taken out of the ground. Every time they dig, they find more corpses, sometimes in places they never expect. Sometimes they only find parts of a person or a corpse decomposed beyond recognition. According to the Gaza government media office, some bodies were found decapitated or had their skin and organs removed. Children, elderly women, and young men are said to be among the dead. Rescue workers say they found bodies with their hands tied behind their backs, which the UN Human Rights Office said indicates serious violations of international human rights law and international humanitarian law. The Zionist regime denies it buried the Palestinian bodies, claiming instead that it had respectfully exhumed the dead searching for Israeli captives. There are so many tears at Nasser Hospital today and so much pain. It's hard to find the words to describe this scene.
The feeling of seeing someone find their relative is indescribable. The way mothers cover their dead sons in a shroud and accompany them to the cemeteries. Every sight journalists capture, they do so silently. They can't speak. They cry blood as they film. Their hands are shaking so much their cameras lose focus. But they start over and try again. The Palestinian Civil Defense said recently it has found hundreds of bodies of Palestinians buried in mass graves by Israeli regime forces in the courtyard of Nasser Hospital in Khan Yunis in the southern Gaza Strip. At least 200 bodies had been retrieved from two mass graves in the medical compound recently. As the search continued, rescuers estimated there to be at least 400 bodies. The Gaza government media office said some of the bodies found had been decapitated and had their skins and organs removed. According to Al Jazeera, the bodies of children, elderly women and young men were among those found. Rescue teams said some bodies had their hands bound behind their backs, suggesting they were executed and buried on the spot. Middle East Eye could not independently verify the reported conditions of the bodies. As the news of the mass graves spread, many people arrived at the hospital in the hope of finding members of their family who had gone missing. The mass graves were discovered weeks after Israeli regime troops ended a three-month invasion of Khan Yunis, during which ground forces repeatedly attacked Nasser Hospital. The hospital, Gaza's second largest and the backbone of the health system in southern Gaza, was put out of service after deadly Israeli raids in February, when 10,000 people had been sheltering at the medical complex. The army stormed the hospital twice, following a weeks-long siege in January, during which 200 people were detained, according to the UN Office for the Coordination of Humanitarian Affairs, and hundreds of patients and displaced people sheltering in the building were forcibly removed. Medical staff reported being stripped naked, beaten, and humiliated by Israeli regime forces, with many staff and patients targeted by sniper fire. In March, the British media released verified footage showing detained and kneeling people inside the complex. Following the raid, it also verified footage documenting 21 instances of fire targeting staff and patients during the siege. Health officials said there was no power and not enough staff in the hospital to treat around 200 patients who remained there after the siege. According to Palestinian Health Ministry spokesperson Ashraf Al-Ghudra, the hospital's generators failed, cutting the water supply, while sewage flooded emergency rooms, making it impossible for the remaining staff to treat intensive care unit patients. He added that a lack of oxygen supplies, also a result of no power, caused the deaths of at least 7 patients. The Zionist regime of Israel said the hospital was housing Hamas resistance fighters, a claim it has regularly made when attacking hospitals in Gaza, despite not having produced any credible evidence of a military presence inside them. This is not the first mass grave that has been unearthed at a medical facility in the Gaza Strip. The discovery follows another earlier this month at Ashrafa Medical Complex in Gaza City, formerly Gaza's largest hospital, which was left in ruins after a two-week assault by Israeli regime forces in late March. Several bodies were found in the hospital's courtyard, including at least one person wearing underwear, who appear to have been executed recently, according to an Al Jazeera Arabic reporter at the scene. After Israeli regime forces withdrew from the hospital on April 1st, having destroyed most of the medical complex, teams from several government ministries were deployed to Ashrafa to remove and identify the bodies. The searches were initiated after survivors said they witnessed a summary execution of Palestinians by Israeli regime forces during the raid. The Zionist regime military officials said its forces had killed 200 people and abducted 900 during the 15-day assault on the hospital. Gaza civil defense said around 300 people had been murdered. The army said it conducted its raid without harming civilians and medical personnel. Medical organizations and eyewitnesses strongly rejected that claim. Ahmad Al-Maghdama, a Palestinian plastic surgeon, and his mother, Yusra Al-Maghdama, a general practitioner, were among those killed.
Welcome to the Israel Watch, which continues to monitor the repercussions of the Iranian attack on the Zionist entity and its results. Threats of an attack on Rafah have garnered the attention of the Zionist media, as well as the failure of the aggression on Gaza to achieve its objectives. The prospects of reaching a prisoner exchange deal have diminished, and confrontations in the occupied West Bank have escalated. In addition to that, the sanctions that the United States intends to impose on the Nizza Yehuda Brigade. I'd like to go and welcome my guest today, Dr. Hayat Al-Haridi, a researcher in media and politics. Welcome, doctor.
Hi, thank you.
Thank you. After the Iranian attack on the Israeli entity, discussion escalated regarding what Zionist experts call the Iranian threat. This has instilled fear among Zionists, especially after Iran's success in showering the entity with hundreds of drones and missiles hitting vital targets. Well, doctor, I do want to go ahead and start off with our latest developments. Abu Abaydah has actually just spoke, and he said that the Iranian attack has set new rules. What is your point on that?
Definitely, because the huge Iranian attack that was actually a surprise to all the players, international players and regional players. And the attack, its symbolism, and the fact that it shows the failure of the Israeli deterrence is definitely a new phase regarding this war. And it shows more how Israel today is weak, and how it should count to whether or in case they wanted to escalate the war.
Well, as we know also today on Israel's northern front with Hezbollah, Hezbollah was able to reach today its deepest attack, reaching actually Akka. What is the point on this? What do you think are the your opinion on this?
I think if we follow the responses of Hezbollah before the Iranian attack and after, we noticed that there is a difference in the nature of the attacks and the geography of the attacks. And this has also different reasons. One of the reasons is, you know, that Israel threatened to bomb or to attack Lebanon in various...
Even reaching Beirut. Yes,
reaching Beirut and also Iran and so on. And we saw that this was just talks. However, Hezbollah is sending to Israeli messages that we can attack you at the heart of your cities regardless or whether you consider attacking the deep of Lebanon. And also, we know that today there was an assassination assassination operation in the south and also in a region that is not considered among the rules of confrontation between Hezbollah and Israel. So this is a message that we can reach you. And this is a message to show that Hezbollah has a deterrence policy and is able to respond to any threat on Lebanon.
Has Iran's attack actually caused a security dilemma for, say, in Israel in terms of how militarily to counter such attacks?
Of course. First of all, there is this Israeli arrogance that they were sure, quite sure, that Iran will never attack Israel directly. So, first of all, they miscalculated the Iranian response. And second, the amount of the missiles and the nature of this attack again shows that despite all these preparations from Israel and its allies in the region and the USA and the Britain, however, Iran succeeded to launch a strategic attack. Iran, the attack of the Iranian state, actually is so clever because it shows the weakness of the deterrence policy, and this is very crucial.
Yes.
To Israel. And also, without causing an escalation to war, they sent their messages, and also they revealed strategic military places for Israel. And in contrast, Israel didn't know anything about the military capabilities of Iran. That's why for all these reasons, yes, they were surprised, and they didn't expect this strategic, calculated response by Iran.
So anyone who undermines it is committing a crime against the state of Israel. What is the significance of these statements, Doctor?
This shows that today there is a big dilemma in the Israeli society. We know that the foundation of the Israeli entity is on the premise that it is a safe place, and they promised their people that they're gonna be safe and they will live peacefully, and that they actually undermined their enemies, whether Hamas, whether Hezbollah, and also regarding the ability of Iran and willingness of Iran to attack. So basically, since October 7, the trust of the Israelis toward their government was shaken, and also the attack of the Iranian attack, the symbolism of this attack, the message behind this attack also was a severe blow. And actually today there is a big dilemma whether about the efficacy of all these military strategies. And we know, and they know, that without the support of the international forces, Israel would have fallen a long time ago.
Do you believe the chief of security delayed his resignation? I mean, like he said, he delayed it until today. Is it related to the internal military or the security institution conflicts between the military and the political institutions?
Yeah. We can talk about two reasons for the timing of the resignation. First of all, we know that the Israeli government is searching for someone to blame regarding
someone
the failure.
Has to take
yes,
the blame.
Someone has to take the blame. And also, they miscalculated and they undermined Hamas threat because they believed that they succeeded to contain Hamas. And also, after 7 months, the Iranian attack also was another proof that these strategies of the military are failing, and that they are miscalculating everything. So basically, after the Iranian attack, the timing for such resignation is better, I think, than before, because we know that the military apparatus of the Israeli military apparatus is very complex, and we are expecting the resignations of many different security personnel.
So there's going to be more resignations
after,
expected.
Yeah, I believe so. And again, this is a way or an attempt to show that there is someone responsible for these failures. We are not talking about one failure. We are talking about October 7. We are talking about the North North with the Hezbollah.
Yes.
And also we are talking about, and this is the turning point, I believe, the Iranian attack that would change everything in this war.
Well, most Zionists don't believe that the occupation army is capable of achieving victory in Gaza. And if elections were held today, Netanyahu would fall. This was revealed by the latest opinion poll conducted within the entity. Actually, these statistics actually resembles the results of recent polls in the entity regarding the failure of the aggression on Gaza and the necessity to hold new elections. Yeah. What is your opinion on this poll?
Actually, I believe that the Israeli society is more aware than, unfortunately, the majority of the Arab world about the failure of Israel in this war. We are talking on the military level, and after 8 months, the Palestinian resistance is still capable of launching rockets against Israel. And again, as we mentioned before, the Iranian attack at Hezbollah. So basically, yes, today the Israelis are aware that this government failed to protect them. But here I want to point out that the problem in Israel is not about conducting the war. It's about how conducting the war. Yani, even the ministers and the former prime ministers, when they criticize Netanyahu, this is again one of the attempts to search for someone to blame, because for the first time in the Israeli history, Israel is weak. That till that point, it's weak and is unable to prevent attacks in different places.
Well, doctor, as you're mentioning, I mean, it's correct that most of the public in the Zionist entity is right wing, right?
Yeah, yeah. And even, I mean, personally, I don't believe that there is much difference between the right wing and the left wing. The all the factions and all the groups in Israel, they agree on the necessity of conducting a war not only against Hamas but also against Hezbollah in the north.
Well, also, as we know, the right wing actually, their ideology opposes the two-state solution.
Exactly. So the question today is not about the idea of the war, but about how to conduct this war through, for example, like what is happening today regarding October 7 and the aggressions of the Israeli operation, or whether we go for another option like the containments and the diplomatic proposals. But we know that all of them, they refuse not only the wing, they refuse the two-state solutions, and they refuse the idea of a Palestinian state. However, we have a group that is more diplomatic than the other group.
Well, doctor, I do want to go ahead and start off with Abu Abaida's against latest comments that the conditions will remain, with the withdrawal. What is your point on this, or opinion?
Yeah, of course, there Israel is trying to impose its own conditions regarding the exchange. And when they talk about that Hamas is refusing the negotiations, we know that this is not true. And Obaida today said it.
Yes, and he also mentioned about lifting the siege and about returning the displaced.
Yeah, exactly. So today Hamas is clear. Actually, they are clear since the beginning of this war that we need a ceasefire, a complete ceasefire and lasting ceasefire, and also regarding the removal of the withdrawal of the Israeli troops, and also regarding the removal or ending the besiege of Gaza. Today, Israel is refusing all these conditions.
So, and why is Netanyahu actually putting the blame on Hamas?
This has been always the case. That the Israelis, we are familiar with the Israeli way of dealing with the issues. They always portray themselves as victims. They need always someone or something to blame. And they always portray themselves as I mentioned, that they are the good people, they want the peace and so on. However, the other are not. And this is also, this is a message for, or a way to try to appeal to their people inside Israel, in the Israeli society, and also to the international players like the United States and the Europe, especially after the criticism that they received throughout the previous weeks. So this is a way to appeal to them for the arming, for the support, financial support, and also in order to appear to their people for Netanyahu. I mean that he is confident and they are working for the hostages, but we know that this is not true.
Well, with that, we're going to go ahead and move over now to the Zionist social media platforms, which launched a fierce campaign against Netanyahu for his failure to eliminate the resistance in Gaza. Here are some comments.
Ronnie, you can't believe a word Netanyahu says. Avi, you are the biggest enemy of Israel. You have divided, shattered,